Welcome to the Thunderdome Podcast. I'm your new host, Amy McCarthy. My late husband started this podcast to share people's experience, strength, and hope. I started off season 4 2 weeks after my husband's unexpected overdose. His death brought me to a year-long women's rehab center because I knew I couldn't hold on to my recovery alone without support. Each episode will be an individual intimately sharing their battles with addiction and what inspired them to fight for their life and their recovery. Reminding us all to never give up, it takes what it takes, recovery is possible, and no one's a lost cause. All right, hi guys. Thank you for listening to the Thunderdome. This is your host, Amy McCarthy. Today is November 16th at around like 11:45 in the morning. I'm here with my friend Isaac, who I've known for a long time, and he's been nice enough to ask me to agree to be on this episode. So as you all know, I've asked him what his favorite quality is in a person, and he said integrity. So Isaac, why do you like integrity?
Well, it's something that if you can deal with people a lot better if they have integrity with their actions. You can trust them more easily if they exhibit that.
Yeah, it's kind of like a good baseline.
Yeah, you can survive a lot of conflicts and things if there's integrity involved on both sides.
Okay. So I'm just going to be transparent. You're not, you don't really struggle with addiction very much, or you haven't really struggled with addiction. One of the things that we wanted to talk about is your experience with homelessness. Because you were homeless for a few years, and I've heard some accounts and stories of it, but not quite everything in like a timeline. So I'm kind of interested to hear about it all too. So tell us about how you became homeless, how it started. Just kind of send us through the story.
Well, it's a very complicated story. Okay. I guess the easiest way to tell it is just to, as the base of it, found myself in a toxic relationship, and there was a lot of abuse coming my way from this person, and it kept escalating, and I didn't have a good support system or group to help get myself out of it. And I had children with this person before a lot of the worst of it really came to light. Had hopes that things might work out, but I didn't realize that this person lacked that integrity characteristic. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of things came to head, and eventually, I made the mistake of having children with her, and so we got tied to this whole thing that like I couldn't get away with from it without like abandoning my kids or something. And I wasn't willing to do that. So that kind of helped me or kept me anchored to this situation and made it a lot more difficult.
So you were kind of like stuck in this relationship out of
love. Yeah. Yeah. Like in trying to reach out to some people for help, like just it fell on deaf ears, or it was the people that did have open ears didn't have any resources to help me with. Mm-hmm. I also, this was before too, I should add that before I was diagnosed with ADHD and a bit of autism spectrum. And I was struggling with depression at the time too, and anxiety disorder. And this was also before the whole Obamacare came into effect. And so I was in a situation where I had very little, if any, insurance. Mm-hmm. What I did have wasn't going to cover the long process of mental health treatment to make these kind of diagnoses. Mm-hmm. And so I was just kind of floundering and stuck and just treading water, like, basically. Yeah.
So when you said that you reached out to people, but they didn't quite believe you, how did people usually react when you would try to talk about the abuse from this lady?
Some people would be kind of dismissive of it in the sense of like, oh, well, can't be being abused. You're a man, you know, like, especially like systemically, there's like a lot of support groups and systems for women in a situation like that, but not so much for men. Mm-hmm. And so you kind of get stuck in a situation that, you know, there's prejudice towards it. You know, it's treated as if it doesn't exist. And this was particularly evident when I woke up one night after having been like up for 24 hours before and had only been asleep for a couple hours. Like I had fallen asleep after a long stint of not sleeping. And I woke up to find my now ex on top of me, hitting me and yelling at me to wake up. Like, and I was already exhausted. That's why I'd fallen asleep. And shortly after that happened, the police showed up.
Do you know why she was on top of you, hitting you?
She was mad that I'd fallen asleep because apparently I had chores to do, kind of thing. Okay. Yeah, that type of that type of attitude and control happening. Mm-hmm. And so, like, like I said, shortly after I woke up, you know, waking up to somebody on top of you hitting you, you're just kind of in defense mode and shock. Mm-hmm. And, you know, barely had time to process what was happening when the police showed up. And they intervened, but unfortunately, they basically had even just come there with the already like predetermined notion that you somebody was going to get arrested and it was going to be me because I was the man. Like, they were dismissive of my defense of myself and the fact that I had just woken up and was sleep deprived and stuff. I was like groggy and just, I was disoriented. Mm-hmm. And they kind of used that against me to kind of make it seem like I was like hiding something or trying to deny something that I, you know, trying to weasel out of something that I had actually done. And so they ended up arresting me and taking me to jail and basically not really caring that I was the victim of domestic violence in that situation.
What did your ex say? Was she blaming you during this?
No, she wasn't. She was even like trying to take accountability for it. Oh. She said I didn't do anything wrong. She was trying to like tell the truth and plead the case. You know, she wasn't using it as a
She
wasn't taking advantage of the situation. Yeah. Like she could have, and sometimes she probably would have, but at this time she didn't do that. And, you know, that was like, fortunately, at least with that and being in jail, and, you know, she came to my defense. She contacted my employer, who I was supposed to have showed up for work the next day. I had no way of contacting them mm-hmm. at all. Like, and, you know, keep in mind, I was arrested in my pajamas, taken mm-hmm. to jail without any shoes on even.
Wow.
They wouldn't let me put any shoes on.
So they just kind of got to the scene.
Had, so I had nothing on.
Someone had to go to jail and that was you.
Right.
Just by default because you're male.
Basically.
Yeah. Okay.
It's kind of how the system seems to generally work. Mm-hmm. And this, of course, was right before a holiday weekend.
Okay.
And I got, you know, late at night and I had no way of getting out of jail until the following Monday after the week. Or Tuesday or whatever it was after the 3-day weekend was over mm-hmm. before, because the courts and stuff, that process doesn't move. Mm-hmm. You know, only intake happens 24 hours a day.
But not
you can't get out. You know, no matter how innocent you might be about something, you're going to be there for the duration. I mean, maybe there was a chance that if I had money, I could have gotten bail or something and been released on recognizance. But
so you're like, so you're basically now in jail for 3 days, 4 days?
Yeah, like it was like 3 nights, I think it was.
Okay. And then, so when you, how did you, so did you end up leaving because they found that you were innocent or like they just.
No charges were filed. Okay. Like the state or whoever, you know, city didn't decide to file their own charges, which they could have tried to do. Mm-hmm. But my ex, like she contacted my boss and the best friend of mine who I'd also had a working relationship with. And they came to my defense and, you know, put in like, filed briefs with the court of like, you know, my defense or whatever. Mm-hmm. I forget what it's called, but those type of things that she made the point of initiating happening. So she did come try to make amends. Make
it, yeah. Okay.
As best she could after it had happened. And so then I was finally released with no charges filed and just kind of went back to,
you went back to living with her.
Well, we were living together for been like 5 years at this point.
Okay.
And then she seemed really remorseful, and she had given the appearances of being like ready and willing to make the changes, and not like, it seemed like she'd scared something into her is what it seemed like. And so I let her kind of try to make a man like bygones, trying to have a bygones type of situation and call in a truce, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And for a little while it seemed to work, but then it became apparent that I was the only one who had actually truced. Like, her idea of a truce was that I relented, but she had apparently no plans. So things went back to kind of how they had been. But
you know, that's like, kind of how abuse works. You know, it's like the abuser will say something, try to do whatever they can do to like convince the person that they're going to get better. And then time goes on and it just goes back to the same way it was.
Yeah. And I was, to be fair, too, a bit naive about relationships. I hadn't really had, that was the only real serious long-term relationship that I'd ever had.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't have like the best experience with it. And for whatever it was worth,
and that's kind of like all you knew,
mm-hmm.
especially since you have kids with her, like
it's
a lot more complicated than it just being, that's why people get stuck in dysfunctional.
And I should have left her then. Like, we didn't have the kids yet at that point, but because of the truce thing, like it genuinely seemed like it was going to be better and that everything was fixed after that point. But it seemed like once she had the kids, it's like, okay, now she's got what she wanted kind of thing. And so now she could now she had me like trapped in a way because she knew I wasn't going to like abandon the kids. And so she could manipulate me more and stuff and like get me to do more chore type things or relent on things. And so that just kind of made things worse. And it just eventually got worse to a point where she just basically decided that was like shortly after my second kid was conceived, really. It wasn't even born yet. She decided to kick me out. It was like, okay, she got the kids. And like, I could have kicked her out technically because I was the one on the lease. And she was just a resident status of it. But what was I going to do? Kick out my kids? It was easier and made more sense for me to just leave. And so but I didn't have a support system. I didn't have anywhere really to go other than like one friend did take me in and I was there for a few months living there, but I wasn't able to get things sorted out by then. It's like, and again, I was operating with undiagnosed ADHD and autism and, you know, untreated depression and anxiety disorder stuff. And like post-traumatic stress disorder, like complex PTSD really from the whole situation and lots of things that had happened and happened after the fact too. So I wasn't able to get my shit together, so to speak, in just that amount of time and, you know, start being able to get like getting back to work was like almost an impossibility at the time, like between the mental and physical difficulties. And around about the same time I started like having symptoms and like such of what I was later diagnosed as having fibromyalgia. Mm-hmm. So like I was this like basically onset of it happened like amongst all this abuse and stuff. And so it was just a really complicated situation. And at that point I still like, I didn't really have healthcare. So I didn't go to a doctor unless it was like urgent, life-threatening type of thing. And so it wasn't until like after, you know, being homeless for a while, eventually, so I ended up being homeless and being technically homeless while I was at my friend's for a while, but then I had to move out of there because like it wasn't making enough progress and his roommates weren't on board with the whole thing. It was just wearing out my welcome.
So when you left there, did you just like, was your plan like, what, I mean, just what I was going through your mind?
There's obviously a fear of an apprehension of the situation and what am I going to do and stuff. But I've always been kind of like resourceful and kind of, I guess, persistent about survival of situations and stuff. And so I ended up just becoming homeless on the street, like literally living, like sleeping in doorways or such. And like, because of anxiety disorder and in particular, and like social anxiety aspect of things and embarrassment about the situation and not really being able to talk about it. Like I didn't really have anywhere to go. Like I couldn't just, like some, there are some systems for people to get help in, but a lot of them, you've got to go through all this like red tape, so to speak, to get help. And when you're dealing with an anxiety disorder and social anxiety and where you can't go into buildings amongst people very easily and stuff, it makes it all the more difficult to get the help you need. But I kind of approached it with just, like, I've kind of survived a lot of other things in my life too, that like just powering through mentally, just being persistent. And for this, I guess, not giving up ultimately in the overall, and just powering through and doing what I can, even though, you know, it was difficult. But I approached it with kind of like the attitude of like, well, I'll treat this like an adventure backpacking type of thing. Like I approached it with that kind of like the minimalistic, just having what I could, like if I was backpacking, like what would I have kind of thing. And like
just made the best of it.
I made the best of it that I could. And, you know, when I wasn't able to see the kids, which I mean, it was like part of the time.
Did your ex know that you were homeless, or did she think,
Yeah, she did. And there was a brief period of time where we tried to live together, where she, you know, we tried to just do co-parenting and live together without any being in a relationship, but she just treated me even worse than she had before. Like, I guess just because she had the upper hand. And and ultimately in the years since, I've come to determine that, you know, she seems to just have like a narcissistic personality disorder. Which is like not something I was really aware of. Like I knew, kind of vaguely knew what narcissist was, but not to that degree, not to the type of horrible things that she was capable of doing because of it. Like just not caring about anybody else. It made it all the more difficult. And then it's at one point she decided to move, and she moved from Seattle. She moved to Tacoma. Took the kids with her and moved to Tacoma. And so, and I wasn't really prepared to leave Seattle yet. And Seattle resources for homelessness is a lot better than Tacoma and other outlying areas, especially. So it was like, and I've lived in Seattle at this point now for 30 years.
It's your home.
So it was my home. I wasn't about to just leave, but I didn't have the resources to like have an apartment here. Like it was around the same time that rent started going up like crazy and the economy just started to get crazy. Amazon's influence in the area was really taking hold and shooting up prices of just all the outlying apartment rentals and stuff. And so it was like, I couldn't afford to live in my home city anymore.
So what would you do? Cause I know that you're really good with resources, but like what kind of things did you do to not sleep in doorways? Like what kind of things did you pick up that helped you like survive?
Well, one of the best things was there's a compression type of sleeping bag that you can compress it into a really small little space. And I ended up getting one of those with actually it was free from there's a resource center in Ballard called the Bridge Care Center. And they have a clothing bank that they give stuff out to the needy, you know, homeless people, and not even exclusively homeless, but it's all donated stuff that they have. And mostly clothing, but they do also get other stuff like backpacks and sleeping bags and other things like that that come in. And I just happened to luck upon one of these compression sleeping bags. And I was able to stuff it in the bottom of my backpack and would just have it on me. It was light. It didn't really take up a lot of space. And so that helped me be able to like sleep. Like if I had to sleep in a doorway or something, then I would have a good sleeping bag that I didn't have to carry a big sleeping bag and, mm-hmm. you know, look like I was
so would camping. You, so like what, so you were literally just kind of like backpacking, so to speak, through Seattle, like
right.
just hanging out
yeah,
doing, throughout the day and then yeah. find a place to sleep. Like, did you not stay in shelters? Did you
not? I, not for the first like several years, because it was several years in before I got to a point where I ended up getting medical coverage.
Okay.
And was able to start getting mental health treatment and medication and stuff. And then that made it so I could be in these environments without it, like, just seriously, like, overwhelming me and stressing me out and giving me, like, panic attacks and mm-hmm. such like that. So, like, but it took me ending up with pneumonia and ending up in the hospital for a week. Which was where I found out that I had health insurance that had been like reactivated because Obamacare had happened. And so like, and I didn't realize, like, I wasn't in really very well connected with what was going on in the world and news and stuff. Mm-hmm. I had a cell phone and I had, you know, some internet, you know, and social media connection and with people and some information, but I wasn't really,
well, it's in hard to like be
touch. I wasn't really connected with it to that degree. And then,
yeah, well, it's hard to be like, be in the know mm-hmm. about like what's going on in the world when you're direct, like lively, you know, like it's hard to, like, you had to worry about just like your day and like living. And
yeah, yeah, it became a matter of like just surviving each day. And that was all the energy there was mm-hmm. before. It was just to survive each day and then do it again the next day.
Were you scared?
There was a lot of like anxiety and fear and just scared about what was going to happen and just not, the unknowingness of it all. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, again, I'm, you know, I have two little kids that I'm like attached to, and I'm just, you know, concerned about doing the best I can to get back to a state where I can be a better father for them, figure for them.
Did you see them at all? Like, did you visit
them? Yeah, somewhat regularly to an extent for a while. Like, we were able to work out an arrangement where, even though I was homeless, like, sometimes she would drop off the kids like at a park for the day, and I would just hang out with the kids like at Seattle Center, for example, or something mm-hmm. of that nature, or a children's museum or something. Because, you know, when the kids were just like four or five or whatever, it was mm-hmm. they enjoyed that more. But now they're older, they don't really enjoy going to such a place. But we would do that. Like, she would just drop them off with me. Or I would go get the kids from her house and take them to a park for a while and just kind of get to see them whatever spots of time I could. Mm-hmm. And some of the time, you know, she would go and she had started seeing some guy. And then so she would, some of the time she would go visit him for like the weekend or something. And she would let me stay at her house with the kids while she went and stayed mm-hmm. at her new boyfriend or whatever's house.
Okay.
So there were things that were working out with it that made it kind of work. And so I wasn't like, a lot of the time I wasn't like 100% homeless in the sense of like when I would be able to stay at her place for a few days, I would have somewhere to sleep, you know, and have a house, you know, could cook for the kids and myself and, mm-hmm. and such. So there were some things like that that kept it from being like a 24/7 homelessness kind of thing most of the time.
Yeah. Were you ever like, were you just kind of like in the middle of your homelessness, were you just kind of thinking like, okay, well, I'm homeless now and then this is just how it is? Or was there a goal in place to get out of homelessness? Or were you just so crippled by your anxiety where you couldn't think that far ahead?
There was kind of a mix. Like, there was definitely the element of being crippled by the circumstances and my anxiety and such that kind of prevented me from taking some actions that I maybe could have if I had been at a point where I was having the mental health treatment that I ultimately ended up getting. Mm-hmm. But like for a while I didn't have that. Like I said, until I got pneumonia and went to the hospital and then found out through the process of looking for financial assistance or whatever that, oh, you have insurance. And I was like, what? Okay. That's good to know. So then I was able to go start seeing some therapists and psychiatrists and, you know, other doctors and stuff to look for a diagnosis for all the things that were ailing me and that I was just suffering through.
So how did that whole process kind of like, so you have insurance, you started to go seeing like providers. Mm-hmm. Like what, were you surprised when they diagnosed you with ADHD and like all these things, or was it, and like, did the knowledge, I'm sure there was like closure and kind of right. like knowing something wasn't quite right with like your mental space.
Like a lot of these things I had a notion and kind of knew for a long time. Like mm-hmm. I knew like these traits fit me, but it took a while. Like before I got to that point of being able to get diagnosed to really, put all the pieces together. Mm-hmm. And like in a lot of respects, I kind of already had self-diagnosed a lot of things. Like one of my best friends for a long time, when I met him, you know, I didn't know when I first met him, but shortly thereafter meeting him, finding out that he was autistic and had been, you know, diagnosed as a child and stuff. And like, we became really good friends, and I just started noticing like lots of little traits about him and stuff that he would describe as part of his autism, where I was just like, that really sounds familiar. Like that would be, sounds like it could be an explanation for this experience or that experience that I'm having mentally. And social anxiety kind of related kind of stuff, but like social interactions and stuff like that, that I struggled with, that like a lot of it kind of made sense if I put it in the picture of having autism. Like, mm-hmm. it's like, oh, well, that explains that. Like I, from probably my teenage years, even a little younger, but I distinctly remember, you know, going through these, like struggling with some of these things and really thinking, just being convinced that my brain is wired differently than mm-hmm. other people. But I didn't know what ADHD yeah. was. I didn't, like, I kind of maybe had vaguely heard of ADD, but didn't really associate it with something that, you know, I thought of it was just that it was like, you can't sit still. Like the fidgety kids in class, they don't pay attention and they're always, you know, mm-hmm. in La La Land yeah. or something. And that wasn't me. I could sit still just fine. But in my mind,
your mind was jumping
doing that. And yeah. I didn't really, took a long time to really connect those two things to realize that like, I'm not just in a normal place that I'm just not adapting too well. It's like, I'm just in a different place. Mm-hmm. And I didn't, you know, it took a long time to identify that. But when I was identified and confirmed, and it was like, yeah, it makes sense.
So when you were diagnosed with that ADHD and you realized that you were like on the spectrum of autism, that's when they would start giving you like treatment kind of thing. Like they gave you
right.
medication.
Right.
And then did you notice a difference right away?
Well, I did like almost immediately when I like, before I got the ADHD diagnosis and started that medication, I had already known that I had depression problems and stuff. That was something. So that was something that just, when I finally had healthcare, that was something that the first thing they got treated was like, let's help with this. And I started taking medication for that. And that helped a lot with it. It helped kind of give me back some focus and the ability to kind of just sit calmly in a coffee shop even for a while without getting anxious and getting like, you know, got riled up in a state where I just had to get out of there. Like that helped calm me down a lot, but it didn't like, you know, solve all the problems, but it helped me. Like I was able to like sit down and read a book for the first time in literally years because I just couldn't sit there and I couldn't focus on it. Like I was too, my brain, that was just, everything was just too much. And I couldn't even sit and focus on a book, until I started taking the antidepressants. And so I noticed a difference with that, but there were still other aspects where I just didn't feel present very much, very well. Like I wasn't like confident, I lacked like confidence, self-confidence, and just a lot of mentally related things that I struggled with, that they were still there. They'd been helped a little bit, but, mm-hmm. but then, and then I got diagnosed with fibromyalgia, and that explained some of the stuff a little bit too. Some of the depression was maybe related to that, and brain fog kind of stuff. But the attention aspect of things, like when I would be in conversations with people, a lot of times I was just like kind of faking my way through it. Like, like just, but not trying to follow, trying to listen and trying to comprehend everything that was in the conversation, but not being really able to, and just having to just kind of fake it through it. But, and so, but eventually I was able to see the right therapist and psychiatrist for enough time that we eventually thought that, like, well, let's try this. They thought, well, we'll try this out. Like, we'll go ahead and give you a trial, little prescription.
Okay. Sorry. We had to take a little bit of a break, but we're just going to go back to where we were. So Isaac, you were talking about, the medications that you had just been prescribed, ADHD, depression, and like you're talking about the changes that you noticed.
Right. And I was just at the depression state before. And then to cope with the anxiety stuff, I was ended up getting prescribed what was a Klonopin to help with anxiety. And that worked really well. Like, but I, in very, very small doses was all I needed. Mm-hmm. And it helped me be able to like go into grocery stores and shop and wait in line and not have to a panic attack and having to abandon one of my shopping or come back later kind of thing. It enabled me to be in situations that I had too much anxiety over before. But it then shortly after that, though, was when the ADHD diagnosis came in. Because we tried just a very small initial dose of Adderall. And it was like within the first day or two, I think it was that quickly that I noticed a profound difference in how my experience with my, in my own brain, in my own self was. Like I felt more present and connected to like the world and not like dissociated. And so we knew we were on the right path because it was the kind of thing that if I didn't actually have ADHD, the medication wouldn't have really done what it did.
Mm-hmm. So at this point you're on medication for ADHD, depression, anxiety, and then anything
else? And the other thing too, about when I got the when I got on Adderall, my, like a lot of my anxiety and such, like kind of went away. I stopped really using Klonopin, really needing it, because the anxiety that I was having, a lot of it was mental, associated with my mental state. And so a lot of that went away. Or what wasn't completely gone was at a place where I could manage it.
Without medication.
Well, okay. Like with the, without additional without medication. Yeah.
Okay. So when you were finally seeing improvement, you were still,
I was homeless, still struggling with all those things. And I was, I was still homeless throughout this entire process.
Okay. All right.
And when I got on the medications though, it started to help me to get to a state where I was able to go actually check into some shelters and found some shelters that I could actually stay.
Before you'd be too anxious to go to shelters because it would be a crowded place.
Yeah, right? Crowded place. There, you know, a lot of all complete strangers, and you know, you're already kind of in an embarrassing kind of situation. And it doesn't, it helps a little bit, not like a lot, that other people there are in a similar situation, because it doesn't really change your situation. Mm-hmm. You're still experiencing it.
Yeah.
But because of the medications, it enabled me to go and like do that kind of process, which was pretty helpful.
Okay.
And
so when, like, I'm just imagining, like, now that you have kind of a handle on anxiety and you can kind of function a little bit more, a little bit better, I guess. Is that when you kind of, because you've told me stories about your process of getting out of homelessness, and it seems like a long process.
Yeah.
Like, did you just kind of start feeling more comfortable with piece by piece climbing out of it, or was it Like, what was, when did you start initiating getting out of that situation?
Well, at the time I was doing some of what I could with my lack, you know, I didn't have resources really, but I was trying to get on the like housing list with like Section 8. Okay. And just all the kind of places that like you'll get sent to if you call like 211 or whatever for help information, and just the kind of things like, yeah, like the state, the Section 8 in particular kind of stuff, the HIP, the HUD stuff. And just, there's a lot of programs, but there's the low income housing institute and such, but there's such a long, like such a demand for it that there's long waiting lists. And to get help with some of these, you had to like win a lottery drawing just to get on a wait list to get to a point where you can get another lottery drawing or something to try it. It was just a ridiculous thing. And I got myself on the list, but like nothing ever came of it. Like, you know, it's like every year you'd resubmit and, you know, you still wouldn't hear anything for till the next year. It'd be time to do it again. And you just, nothing. I was on those lists for a long time and nothing was happening. And it was when I went to, the Harborview Mental Health Clinic was where I ended up with getting some to my mental health treatment, primarily with a psychiatrist there and stuff. And they have a strong commitment to helping like, you know, homeless people get reentry. Mm-hmm. They've even got like a job training kind of program at the hospital where you can get paid a small little amount to just go help collect recycling around the campus and stuff. So I was able to get attached to that program and kind of help me feel like it would be possible for me to work again. Cause at that point I was like, was mentally and also physically, I just didn't feel capable of having much of a job. Like if I did have one, I didn't feel capable of like having, I hadn't really worked much for a long time. I'd lost a job I had when I had my, you know, kids, and it was just hard to get back into that particular industry because it required certifications that like required money to get recertified and just that kind of thing.
But it sounds like that you started the job that you got from Harborview, the recycling thing. Sounds like you started building confidence. Like,
yeah, exactly. Okay. And that's what it was designed for. It's what its intention was. And like, and the guy that was running, the boss for it, you know, was somebody, he'd gone through the program himself. He was a former meth addict who was now overseeing this whole program at the hospital, like as an employee of the hospital. Like, and he'd gone through it. And so it was nice to have like a peer like that, like somebody who'd actually been in the same place you were. Although, I wasn't a meth addict, but he had also been homeless and, you know, been a similar experience. But like a lot of people there are like, you know, going through similar things.
Right. So, and this actually, I guess this is the tangent of what I'm going to ask, but I was going to ask, like a lot of people that, like you said, in that program, or a lot of people that were homeless, a lot of them are in recovery or in active addiction.
Right.
Did you meet a lot of people that when you were homeless that were in the same state as you, same struggles, but also not having a problem with drugs?
Yeah. And there were a number of people, like a lot of friends that I had and that weren't in that state. I mean, I knew people that were also, but I guess everybody's just handles things a little differently. They've all come from a different place, and you might be having the same kind of circumstances that you're put into, but everybody's got a different like history and experience and like skill sets and what just help, you know, coping skills to an extent, you know. And so, you know, some people are more susceptible to addiction than others.
Yeah. And the reason I pointed on that is because I feel like a lot of people think that people are homeless because they're addicted to drugs or they're choosing to be homeless, when a lot of people are homeless because of so many other variables.
It's like, for example, almost always other variables that put them in the homelessness. And then for a lot of people, even the ones that did have some drug use prior didn't really have a problem with it. because it was like managed in a, you know, they were in a safe environment, for example. And like from the people that I knew, there were very few of them, I think, that became homeless because of drugs.
Right. Oh, like, wow. Okay.
I don't, there might've been some that had eventually been to a point where they were kept stayed homeless because of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was just going to ask, like, it would make sense. I mean, I can understand how drugs may not lead someone to homelessness, but being homeless and having feeling hopeless,
right,
that can lead to someone using drugs because
self-medicating. Yeah. You have to, and with the medical system in this country basically not being a healthcare system, that's where a lot of people get to a point where like then you need something to cope.
Yeah.
Whatever. And everybody's got a different, you know, kind of vice or, you know, experience.
And
or
drugs
things,
are so readily available. Okay. It's just interesting because I feel like a lot of people blame drugs. I mean, I know it comes
into play.
It's a
convenient scapegoat.
Yeah, it totally is. But it's...
helps fund the drug war. You know?
Yeah. Just interesting thing to think about.
But, the people that I knew that, like I said, like that did use certain drugs before homelessness, it almost never was because of those drugs that they were homeless. Or if it was related to it, it was kind of a side relation, like... maybe they got kicked out because of the drugs, but the drug itself hadn't like done anything to them. It was just other people
reacting
to it and giving them a problem that they didn't have. And then it just got exacerbated. But there's just so the lack of help and assistance for homeless people like kind of perpetuates those things. So somebody might have a minor problem or be susceptible, but they'd be perfectly functional. Like there's plenty of alcoholics that are perfectly functional at going to work and having a job, but they still have an addiction,
right?
And it's still a problem, but manageable because they had just enough of a support system.
Right. I have, so when you were homeless, did you notice, how did people that weren't homeless, how did they treat you? Like, did you notice
there's definitely a lot of people that just kind of like at the very least, like ignore that you exist. Like if they,
that's the one thing that I've heard a lot from people is that when you're homeless, the only people that actually acknowledge you are other homeless people.
Not entirely, but there's a lot. Yeah. And I made a point during my experience is like, I mean, partially because of like embarrassment and anxiety and such, and just kind of hiding from basically being in a state of perpetually like hiding wherever I was, like blending in. Even before homelessness, I had kind of a good knack of just kind of blending into my environment, and adapting to stuff. But I made it a point of like I said earlier about making it a backpacking kind of thing where like I approached it as if I was on like a backpacking trip across, you know, wherever. I was traveler, you know, I just presented that way, and like being able to have a sleeping bag that I could hide in my backpack, and not, there were no outward obvious indicators that I was homeless. Okay. I stayed relatively clean, and sure, I might have the same clothes on for a couple of few days
in a row,
but only a few people like would even notice that.
Yeah.
Especially if you keep moving, you know, like I moved around the city. I like rode the buses around. And for a period of time, I've made a point of just going somewhere in the city I'd never been. It was just like, I'll be a tourist in my own city kind of thing. Mm. And just, so that was kind of how I occupied myself when I wasn't like with my kids. Because like trying to work wasn't feasible. You can't just go get a job when you're homeless, you know, like there's so many barriers
there's
to
so
it.
So many things working against you to get out of homelessness. Yeah.
Yeah.
But so then, so tell us about kind of, because now you have your own little nice apartment that you've had for a few years.
Yeah, I have the apartment now for that. I've been here for 4 years.
Yeah, so you used the resources to kind of get your own place. And we don't have to go into detail much about that unless you really
want. Well, I would like to say, though, that Harborview Mental Health Clinic was really instrumental in helping me get where I am today. Because not only was that work, you know, kind of retraining program, that they had there pretty useful. They have a connection to a rehousing channel that they go go through that with in association with something called Shelter Care Plus, I think is what it's called, or Shelter Plus Care, something like, I forget what exactly what it's called, but it's they have a program that like Plymouth Housing is like associated with and providing that finds homing for housing for people. And I was able to get in the application for that. And it took about a year after I first applied for that program that I was offered a different place initially that I thought I was going to be able to have my kids at. Like I thought I was going to be able to get housing help, you know, that would allow me to have my kids enough to get like proper custody amount and mm-hmm. such. But there's a catch 22 there, where if you don't already have your kids 51% of the time or more, you can't get the like 2-bedroom apartment. Mm-hmm. You have to already have your kids.
Okay.
So I didn't have that option. I had nowhere to have them that much to be able to get that. So it was kind of without that place, I wouldn't have it. So it was kind of a catch 22, but they first sent me to a place like that, that was a 2-bedroom kind of thing with, and I was thinking that I was, you know, gonna be able to get a place, but it turned out to be a misunderstanding on somebody's part along mm-hmm. the way that I even ended up there. Cause it was like, no, they're like, no, we can't give you this place without you already having your kids.
So,
but it turned out to be kind of a blessing because the place that I ended up getting shortly thereafter is much nicer than the other place would have been. Mm-hmm. And it's in a much nicer neighborhood than the other mm-hmm. place was. And there's a lot more resources around here and stuff. And ultimately it's been good that I didn't get that first place, even though it would have been bigger.
Mm-hmm. So I guess I just want to kind of go back on the resource, because I think mm-hmm. it actually is really important. Right. You are good with going back on that. So like Harborview
Mental Health Clinic.
Okay.
It's actually, the building is actually on Broadway and not at the main hospital campus, but it's part of Harborview and it's part of the UW Medicine system.
So just a matter of getting involved in that and then getting on the rehousing program, mm-hmm. which is what you said?
I forget what the, what they call their mm-hmm. portion of it there, but they're part of the, one of the programs that's associated with it is I think it's called Shelter Plus Care.
Okay.
But it's managed by Plymouth Housing.
So then you just got on that list, you waited for a year, and in that year they were just trying to find
openings. Yeah, this was only the second place that came up that I was offered when I just, my name came up on the, mm-hmm. you know, in the queue waiting for it. And so, when this place came available, I think I was like moved in like the next day after I found out, once I heard that I got it, I was like able to move in the next day.
That's great. So now that you've lived, and I'm sure a lot of your anxiety, I mean, even though I know that you were, you know, helped with medication and all that kind of stuff and the ADHD, I'm sure a lot of that stress was also just from being homeless.
Oh yeah.
So when you moved into a place where you finally had like 4 walls around you, what kind of changes did any of those problems that you were having before, did some of those subside? What kind of benefits, like how have you changed from getting out of homelessness?
Well, it was an adaptive process to be sure, to like try to reacclimate myself to like normal living.
Sure, it was hard.
Like, I'd gone for, you know, years with, because of the situation with my ex and the kids and having time at their house, on a semi-regular basis to take care of the kids and such. So I was still kind of maintaining some like cooking and cleaning kind of skills and sets and things like that, even though I wasn't really cooking for myself on a regular basis, mm-hmm. but that took something that took some adjusting to like managing my feeding myself and learning to like cook again. Cause I hadn't really had much of a need for that for all those years. Mm-hmm. Like it was just not an option to like, you know, cook. I was at the mercy of whatever meals were
there
around. Like there are some, I did find some good programs around, you know, throughout the city that they have hot meal programs that they provide for anybody, really, like not just to homeless people, but they were instrumental in me, you know, surviving and thriving as best I could as of a homelessness. And I met someone who had a home and became a really close friend, and she was somewhat well off financially, and she was really generous with what she had. And I ended up spending a lot of days like just hanging out at her place with her, because she didn't need to work. She was kind of a divorcee who had a lot of money in the bank, just as it happened, and was just, so we hung out all the time. We became best of friends. Yes. And she was really helpful in helping me like just navigate a lot of these things, and just having a resource of just having somewhere to just sit peacefully during the day.
I mean, meeting people that actually have like an open heart like that.
It was huge. Yeah. It was a big factor. Yeah. It wasn't just the mental health clinic stuff, which the medication, I mean, that helped a lot, but developing a good close relationship with somebody that wasn't homeless and was like just still generous, like, cared enough. And
all that.
Okay. Yeah. And being able to have like a proper meal somewhere, like that wasn't like at a community dinners, which is a name of the organization that does a lot of meals around the city. That was one that I frequented a lot, like pretty much every day of the week there was a meal somewhere in one neighborhood of the city. So I would just like take the bus over to each one each day. And so I didn't have to like carrying cans of food around or something like that. Or I wasn't going to camp.
Yeah.
I wasn't like,
oh, so you never stayed like in a tent?
I never stayed in a tent. I was just not really, partially because of the kids. Like I was going to go see them every like other week or every week to a certain extent. It was like, it just didn't make any sense to try to establish any kind of a campground or something somewhere that was a pain in the ass to get to and get out of and stuff to carry. It was just, I wanted to be minimal. Right. I wanted to just have like almost just what I needed for survival. And
we were a backpacker, not a camper.
Yeah, exactly. I was a backpacker, and I had just essentials. Like, I mean, bare minimum, you know, enough to stay warm enough and survive enough, like maybe some snacks and kind of food to keep me going, like
so
just warm gear.
So now that you're in more of like a stable place, you have like, you have a work, you have a house, like you have.
Yeah. I went back to work and I've been working pretty regularly lately.
So it seems like everything kind of took like a 180, like for the better.
Very much so. Yeah.
What do you feel like were the main, things that helped you get from where you were just a few years ago to here?
Well, like I said, this friend that I found, that I met, was
so like human, was a human connection.
Yeah, somebody actually caring and just kind of treating you like a normal person, not like a homeless person.
Yeah.
And opening their doors and their heart to you to be in their part of their life and stuff. And it was a big thing that she did. That was, and like the Obamacare happening to it's give like
resources.
He's creating like a basic health plan that if you can't afford to pay into all this, it's just for profit medical system, like you can actually get some health care at least. And so that was those things were really instrumental in making it possible
to get out of it.
Cause like, I, even after, you know, a couple years of home of how being in an apartment, I still never heard from like Section 8 about anything, like, cause I was still kind of feeling that out a little bit to see if maybe something better would come up. But like, it was just nothing, not just whether it was better or not. It was just non-existent happening.
Yeah. Okay. So we're a little bit about up, but is there anything that you wanted else to like share? Like any things that you've, like life lessons that you've learned being homeless, like things that you, are you grateful for the experience that you went through?
Well, there's definitely, I guess you might say, a silver lining to
silver lining.
The whole experience, and just learning a lot of about life and people that I hadn't before. But
what's like one thing that you've realized about people, or like human nature that you probably didn't really know before. I wouldn't have known if you didn't go through those years of.
Well, there are a number of generous, kind people out there and people that care, but there are also a surprising amount of people that don't care, that don't have any interest in like anything outside themselves. Like, I guess probably they're probably all narcissists, I guess is maybe safe to suppose, but
yeah. And I also feel like being homeless brings out so much of like the instinct of just survival, mm-hmm. where a lot of times people probably don't even have the capacity to care about anyone else because they're just too busy caring about themselves.
Right, right.
Which makes it just really like cutthroat, and it's like a dog eat dog world. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that's neither here or there.
Yeah, but just learning that like that I can survive like the worst of like the worst. That and come back and be thriving and, you know, and like, and I, when I got my apartment, this was just like barely 6 months before the whole COVID pandemic came along and just turned upside down the whole world. Mm-hmm. I was just barely getting acclimated to like doing life as like a normal person again. And then, bam, here comes this whole pandemic that like kind of pushed me back inside and like it blocked my recovery for a while, mm-hmm. because like suddenly I can't socialize. I can't like try to get back out there and do things that normally I would do. Like, for example, like I love music and going to concerts and stuff, and like that wasn't happening anymore.
Mm-hmm. So you're finally like in a place where you can go out, and now that your like medication is right, mm-hmm. you're actually able to go out and do all these things, but you're just isolated.
And I just managed to start working again and managed to get like a job. And well, my industry that I work in right now is events.
Yeah, there's
I'm a technician. And so that was the first industry to really completely die, mm-hmm. when the pandemic was declared and all the rules went into place. It's like, okay, no more events with thousands of people, you know, together. This was before there was a vaccine of any kind, you know, so it was like that work just went poof, like barely before I had it. Like I worked like one day, I think, or 2 days before it happened.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And so I ended up surviving on the pandemic unemployment assistance program that ended up coming around. That was a lifesaver. Mm-hmm. It's like, I mean, granted, I got in an apartment that income-based rent. So for the most of the time I've lived here, like before, you know, when I wasn't working, I wasn't having to pay any rent. So it was my like expenses weren't too great, but I did have kids I was trying to take care of, and trying to, you know, making sure I needed to feed them, mm-hmm. and I needed to like, you know, do things for them and try to supply some, you know, resources for them. And, mm-hmm. So it wasn't like I didn't have expenses I needed to try to cover, mm-hmm. but it was less pressure because I didn't have like a, you know, $2,000 rent thing that I had to try to worry about.
Yeah. Well, that made it easier.
That made it a lot easier for sure.
Well, you're definitely a survivor. I definitely know that. And I will say that you're so kind. Mm-hmm. Every time I've needed help, you've definitely helped me. And I can definitely see like the compassion that you have. And I mean, you look very well put together. And people, I don't think, would have realized that you have gone through so much like abuse and mm-hmm. pain and all the things that you went through. Like, you handle it all very well. But it shows through like your generosity and integrity.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, everyone, for listening to this episode for me and Isaac. I will be with you guys next week. All right. Thank you.